morning. It's good to be with you today. Good to have those that are visiting with us. We're glad that you came our way. Today we're going to be starting a couple of new series this morning and tonight. We will be starting a series of lessons this morning on getting to know the church. And this will be maybe a basic type of study, but it's something that's important. And we often talk about many, you know, spiritual concepts, assuming that everybody's on the same page. And sometimes you realize, well, maybe everybody's not, especially when you are talking to those that are in the world or with other religious groups. And when you talk about something, maybe you're not really, you think you're talking about the same thing and you're not. So we'll be talking about getting to know the church. And we'll probably have about 10 lessons in this series. And tonight we're going to start a series of lessons on the Beatitudes. And so that'll be this afternoon at 5 o'clock, we'll start that series. So we want to, this morning, talk about what is the church. Sometimes in conversations that you may have or things that you read, you find that everybody doesn't have the same understanding about the church and what the church is. So before we go into detail about the nature or function of the church, we have to build the foundation so that we have the same understanding of what the church is scripturally. And it's something that we need to have a proper understanding of that, and it leads us to greater knowledge and appreciation of the work of Christ and the work that we should be doing together. And so, you know, scripturally, what is the church? In the New Testament, which we know is originally written in Greek, the word church is given to us as ekklesia. So you've probably heard that word before. Ekklesia is a compound word. The word ek means out or out of, and the word kaleo means to call or to bid. So that means that the word ekklesia is used of a group of people who had been called out of some place. And from one relationship into another. And so that's the way we understand that word. In Greek literature, this is often defined or used in this way, a gathering of citizens called out of their homes into some public place. So it's people that are coming out of one place into another. And so we can see the word ekklesia used in the book of Acts. So if you turn over to Acts chapter 19, we see the word used here. So it's the word ekklesia, and it means called out. Acts chapter 19, starting in verse 29. In verse 28, when they had heard, they were enraged and said, crying out, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. So the city was filled with confusion, and they rushed together into the theater, dragging out with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians, who were Paul's companions in his travel. But when Paul wished to go in among the crowd, the disciples would not let him. And even some of the Asararchs, who were friends of this, sent to him and were urging him not to venture into the theater. Now, some cried out one thing and some another. And so David read that for us this morning. And so here, a couple of places, the word ekklesia is used. But here it's not used as the term church. You know, they're coming together into the theater. They're gathering together. So sometimes the word is used as gathering. Sometimes the word is used as assembly. Sometimes the word is translated church, and it just depends on the context is how that is termed. But that gives you an idea of what the word really means. The word ekklesia, that we get the word church from, you know, means some people are gathering together in one place. So in this text, you see that this refers to some people being called out of their homes and into a public place. And here it's the theater. And so you see that the word can be sometimes used in a religious sense, and sometimes it's not used in a religious sense at all. And so here it's the citizens of Ephesus gathering together, but certainly not in a religious sense. But we find in the Old Testament that certainly the word ekklesia is not used, because the Old Testament was written in Hebrew, not, not Greek. But when you look at Acts chapter 7, we read about the church in reference to the Old Testament, which is interesting. Acts chapter 7 and verse Acts chapter 7, starting in verse 35. Then Moses, whom they rejected, saying, "Who made you a ruler and a judge? This man God sent as both ruler and redeemer by the hand of the angel who appeared to him in the bush. This man led them out, performing wonders and signs in Egypt and at the Red Sea and in the wilderness for 40 years. This is the Moses who said to the Israelites, 'God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brothers.' This is the one who was in the congregation in the wilderness with the angel who spoke to him at Mount Sinai and with our fathers. He received living oracles to give to us." So you see here the word that is translated in the English Standard Version as congregation. It may be assembly or it may be church in some other translations. But what you see here is that the word ecclesia is used here in Acts to refer back to what happened in the Old Testament. So how could the people in the Old Testament be called a church? Well, that if you don't understand what the word church means or the word ecclesia means, when you think about the word church in our terms, the way some people think about it today, you think, well, they couldn't have had a church in the Old Testament because Christ hadn't established the church yet. And so it's a misunderstanding of the word ecclesia or the word assembly or congregation. You know, these people, Moses had called the people out of Egypt. Remember what ecclesia means? It means called out. These people had been called out of Egypt. And so they had been called out of Egypt. Where were they called to? Well, they're called into the wilderness. So we've got this congregation, this ecclesia, this assembly of people that have come out of Egypt and now are in the wilderness. And so this is really the thrust of what Stephen is saying here, that the Jews were called out. The Jews were God's chosen people. And yet, you know, the Jews rejected him and fell in the wilderness. Of course, you know, the people that were listening to Stephen didn't like this message very much, but that's what he's saying, that they were called out of Egypt into the wilderness. So it's interesting here that you find this word congregation or ecclesia referencing back to the Old Testament. And so ecclesia is a Greek word, but it's used here to refer back to the Old Testament. Also in the book of Deuteronomy, and we won't take the time to look up all of these passages this morning, but in Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 10, it says, "The Lord gave me the two tablets of stone written with the finger of God, and on them all the words that the Lord had spoken with you on the mountain of the midst in the fire in the day of the assembly." And so there's that word again, assembly or congregation. And so these passages, you know, point back to the same type of thing being in the Old Testament. So when you read the word church or you look at the word ecclesia, you're not necessarily talking about the Church of Christ that we think of today. It's an assembly is what it means. The Scriptures speak of an assembly of people. It may refer to an unruly mob. It may refer to the assembly of the Jews. It can refer to people called out of one location or people that are in a relationship together, people that are together in one place. And so what you see here is that the word church or ecclesia can reference different things, but when we talk about it, we are speaking of people who have been called out of something into another thing. We've been called out of the world, and we've been called into Christ by the gospel. And so ecclesia is a collective word. It is talking about the church being the people. And I think most of us here probably understand that. That we see ecclesia as a collective noun. It's a collection of people. And when you see that word church, you're not thinking about some of the things that we're going to talk about later in the lesson. What are you thinking about? You're thinking about people. You're thinking about the called out. It's always a collective noun. It's a plurality of elements. When we have many other words that that exemplify this, that refer to the church. When you talk about a flock, what is a flock? Well, is it one sheep? No. Is it the cage that contains a bunch of sheep? No, it's not that. It's many sheep. When you talk about a family, is a family one person? No, family is many people. A jury? A jury is a collective noun, right? A jury is a collection of people. It's not one person. And Congress, you know, Congress is not one person. It's a group of crazy people. Congress is not one person. So the church cannot be one person. But we use it as a singular noun, don't we? When you look up a church on the internet, what do you usually see? You usually see a picture of a building, right? You see a picture of a building. And some websites, you might see on their website that they've got a picture of the people. They've got a picture there of all the members of that ecclesia or that church. So that really defines it better as to what the church really is. So the church cannot be one person. It designates more than one. And so when we think of the church, we need to think of a collection of people. And that, you know, that's kind of hard today because people don't think about it in that way, but that truly is what it means. So we have many passages that back this up. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 2 talks about the church of God, which is at Corinth. And it's talking about the people there. In Acts chapter 20, verse 28, it says that the elders are given the charge to shepherd the church of God. So are they shepherding a building? Are they? Does that mean that these elders are called on to take care of a physical property? No, that's not what it means. We understand that the shepherds are taking care of the flock. They are taking care of the people. They have a spiritual charge. In the seven churches in Asia that are mentioned in Revelation chapter 2 and 3, it speaks of groups of people in each one of those seven cities that are mentioned. In Matthew chapter 16, verse 18, a very well-known passage where Jesus says, "Upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it." So what was Jesus talking about here that he would build? Did he find a rock that was a good foundation so that he could start building a physical church right on top of that rock? You know, that's not what he's talking about. Was he going to build a corporation? Was he going to build an institution? No, he was building a group of called out people. And so that's what he was talking about when he said, "I will build my church." And many of the problems that arise today in religious organizations begin with this misunderstanding of what the church is. They think of the church as an institution. They think of it as a corporation or a business. And if a church is an institution, then it cooperates with all other kinds of institutions. You know, Rex works at Regions Bank. You know, there's all kinds of different branches. And so people think of the church like a bank. There's the corporate headquarters, and then there's all these other little branch churches all around. And that's not what the word ecclesia means. That's not what the word church means. If we see the church as a plurality of people who have been called out of the world, that is the proper understanding of the church. Consider what we just read in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 2, when Paul is addressing the church there, the church of God or the church of Christ. What is he referring to? We know that Paul is talking about the people. He's addressing the people that are there. He's addressing the saved people at Corinth. He's not addressing a building. He's not addressing a corporation. In Acts chapter 20, those that were to shepherd the flock, were they shepherding an institution or a building? No. You know, they were. It's talking about the people. And the church that belongs to Christ, we need to think of it as God's calling out of those people into a relationship with Him. That's what the church is. So, you know, we don't have to speculate about that. You know, we even if we had absolutely no knowledge of the Greek language, we could still understand the meaning of the word church in the Scriptures. So how do we know that? Well, 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 14 and 15 says, I hope to come to you soon, but I'm writing these things to you so that if I delay, you may know how one ought to behave in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, a pillar and buttress of the truth. So how is the church here described? It's described as a household of God. It's a family of related people. It's a collection of related people because it's talking about the behavior of those people. It's not talking about the behavior of an institution, the behavior of a building. It's talking about the behavior of how these people ought to behave in the church of God. It's a collection of related people. In Ephesians chapter 1, verses 22 and 23, we see a similar thing. Here he says, Paul says, and he put all things in subjection under his feet and gave him to be head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all in all. So Christ is head over all things. How is the church described? It's described as his body. Which is, in other places that Paul talks about the body, he talks about the different parts of the body and that we are all parts of that body and that Christ is the head. And as his body, it's a collection of related members. In Acts chapter 8 and verse 3, we read of Saul. Before he became Paul, he's wreaking havoc on the church. What is he doing? He's wreaking havoc on the church. So he's spray painting the building? No, he's not doing that. He's wreaking havoc on the people. He's wreaking havoc on those Christians that are there. He's persecuting them. Because when Paul says in Galatians chapter 1 that he persecuted the church of God beyond measure and tried to destroy that, he's trying to destroy people. He's trying to destroy their relationships. And of course, he took part in that and mentions that many times. So when he was persecuting, he persecuted the church. He persecuted the people. So we all understand that this. And like I said at the beginning of the lesson, these things seem basic to us. But there's misunderstanding in the world today about what the church is. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 25, we read that Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. What does he love? He loves me. He loves you. He loves all of us. He looked at us as a group of saved people. And so when we read about the church that belongs to Christ, or we speak of the church which is Christ, that's what comes to our mind, or it should. It shouldn't be the picture of this building. It shouldn't be the picture of any building. It shouldn't be an organization. It should be the people. We're talking about the saved people of God. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 32, Paul says, give no offense either to the Jews or to the Greeks or to the church of God. So we've got the Jews, who are they? They're a group of people. The Greeks, they're a group of people. And we've got the church, and it's a building. No, it's not. Every one of these is a group of people. You've got Jews and Greeks, and then you've got the church of God. So you've got these three groups of people. And that's not hard to understand, given this context. We're not going to shift gears when we leave Jews and Greeks and then talk about an institution. We're talking about a group of people. But this is how the church has been falsely defined. It's been falsely defined as an institution. And I thought I had another slide here, so I don't. I don't know what happened to that. But we're going to look at several different ways the church has been falsely defined. Number one, as an institution, which we've already discussed, but we want to say a few more things about this. And how did this idea get here? Well, during the Reformation period, many people were fighting against the Catholic Church and the errors and abuses that were associated with it. And one of the errors of the Catholic Church was its teaching that the institution saves people. And there's a lot of misunderstanding about that. But the New Testament never speaks of the church saving anybody. the ecclesia saving anybody. In Acts chapter 2 and verse 37, when the people are pricked in their hearts, when Peter is speaking on the day of Pentecost, they ask, "What must I do to be saved?" Peter does not respond that the church saves and you need to join the church. No, who saves? Jesus saves. And we sing that song, you know, Jesus saves. We don't have any songs, I don't think, that say the church saves, the church saves. The church is the saved, but the church doesn't save. So this is an error that has arisen as people suggest that, well, you need to be saved. You got to be in the church. Well, if you're saved, you are in the church, but the church doesn't save you. So this is an error that's out there. Verse 47 of Acts chapter 2 tells us that the Lord adds us to the church. So we are a group of saved people who are in fellowship with God after we are saved. And so that's parallel to verse 41 where it says that there were 3,000 souls that were added to them. Who is the them? Well, the them is the other saved people. Those that are already in the church, the other saved people. So if we say that the church saves, we really need to think carefully about what it is that we're saying. I know sometimes we innocently say things that aren't grammatically or factually correct, and we know in our head what it is that we mean to say. We say, "I'm going to church." Well, we know what it is that, you know, "I'm going to worship with the Christians today." It's a lot quicker to say, "I'm going to church. I'm going to go be with the saved people today. I'm going to go worship with my fellow brethren." So we belong to the church because we've been added to the church. But it's not the church that saves us. We are in the church because we were saved. The Lord saves us, not some institution. Also, the church has been falsely defined not only as an institution, but the church has been defined as all religious people, anybody that's religious. So we want to define the church as all religious people, regardless of denomination or what they teach, what they practice, and that you've got the universal church, and then you've got all the little churches that are underneath that are all kinds of different denominations, and you can drive all the way down Highway 119 and see every flavor of church that there is. And so the church, some people think, well, that's everybody that's religious at all. We talked about that some in our class this morning, that there are those that are religious. Nadab and Abihu was mentioned, and some, there was some people that would serve false gods, which was clearly wrong, but there were some people that would serve the true God, but serve Him in the wrong way. And so it goes back to Genesis when you look at Cain and Abel. They're both worshiping the same God. They're both offering sacrifices to the one true God, but one was acceptable and one was not. And so were they both religious? Well, they were both performing an act of religion in offering a sacrifice. But Cain's sacrifice was not acceptable. So you can't say that, the church is all religious people everywhere, and it doesn't matter where you go, you're in the ecclesia. You know, that's clearly against the scriptures. If that wasn't the case, you know, Jesus wouldn't have been so upset with all the religious leaders in his day. Who were they worshiping? Well, they were claiming to worship the true God, weren't they? Jesus wasn't fighting idolatry among the religious leaders of that day. There wasn't any question about what God it was that they had some kind of allegiance to. But they were not serving Him in the right way. So why was Jesus so upset at the religious leaders who were preventing people from truly learning about God and worshiping God if all religious people, regardless of what they did, were saved? In fact, Matthew 7, Jesus says that not everyone who says to me, "Lord, Lord," will enter the kingdom of heaven. And so the church is the group of people who have been called out of the world. They belong to Christ. They are in fellowship with Him. And, you know, somebody that is part of the Lord's body but has not, you know, fully given his or her life to the Lord and is not obedient to the commands of Christ probably fit in that group that Jesus is talking about. And so the church is not all religious people. There's some things that need to be considered with that. And as we've already said, the church is not a building. And this is, you know, fairly common. You think of the church as the building where Christians meet. You talk about going to church, and that conjures up the idea that the building's the church. And like I said, we have it on our website too, the building. And so are we trying to falsely advertise that the church is the building? No, it's helpful to have a picture there so people can say, well, this is where those Christians meet, and they recognize the building when they come by. But there should not be a misunderstanding that this is the church. If we had some kind of damage to the building, their power was off, and we decided to meet somewhere else, would we no longer be the church because we gathered somewhere else? No, we'd still be the congregation. We'd still be the people. We'd still be the same group. It wouldn't matter if we met on the lawn up front or if we decided to go meet in Rex's basement because the power was off here. Wherever we were, we would still be the same group. We'd still be the ecclesia. We'd still be the called out. You know, there's a trend today that there's signs that instead of saying, you know, Church of Christ or whatever, it says a Church of Christ meets here, or it says a congregation of the Church of Christ. And the idea behind people doing those kind of things is to help designate to people that the building is not the church. And you know, I'm not one that really advocates changing signs and things, because I think that the problem is more in people's heads than it is signs. But you know what people are trying to get across is that people are what make up the church. People make up the church. This false distinction can cause problems. In what way? Well, sometimes people make rules that apply in the church building but don't apply other places. So let's say that we do go over to Rex's house, and Rex has got a piano. Well, you know, we're not in the church building anymore. We can have a piano now, and we can... Or we can change something about our worship. We can change something about our practice because we're no longer in the confines of the building, and those rules don't apply to us anymore because we're meeting somewhere else. No, this is just a building. It's just a meeting place. The building is not the church. And so going outside of the building doesn't mean, poof, you know, all the rules are different now. It's just a building. So why is all of this important? You know, why do we need to know this information? Well, it's important because we need to understand that the passages that we're looking at are not applied to, you know, some third party, but they are actually applied to us. The church is us. In Ephesians chapter 3, verses 20 and 21, "Now to him who is able to do far more abundantly than all we ask or think, according to the power at work within us, to him be the glory in the church and in Christ throughout all generations, forever and ever. Amen." This is talking about us. We need to know this information because it's applied to us. Paul says that to him be glory in the church by Christ Jesus. These people that are called out have a responsibility to behave in a certain way because of their relationship with each other and their relationship with Christ. So our lives as saved people that have been added to the church should show the power and glory of Christ. And so we're responsible for that. We're responsible to show the world that Christ has worked in us. And I'm sure that we have all heard the expression or heard preachers say that, you know, if you were on trial for being a follower of Christ, would there be enough evidence to convict you? And we also sometimes know that there are those that proclaim to be Christians, but we sometimes don't reflect that in our life. Have you ever met somebody and have known them for a while and then you find out later that they're a Christian and you were surprised? Why is that? It shouldn't be a secret. It shouldn't be something that somebody accidentally finds out about you. Oh, you're a Christian. There should have been some telltale signs along the way that you are reflecting the glory of Christ. And we have a responsibility, not that we're doing anything for show, not that we're trying to prove to the world that we're a Christian, but it should just show up. There shouldn't be any secret about it. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25, it says, "Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as Christ does the church." Of course, this is a big job that husbands have when it's put this way, that husbands need to love their wife as Christ loved the church. And if husbands did that, there'd probably not be any problems between the husband and the wife if husbands truly love their wives as Christ loved the church. But the thing that we see here is that Christ showed his love for us, and that's used as an example to husbands. And it's also referenced here that why is he doing this? He's giving us his continuous love so that we can be presented holy and without blemish. That we are the ones that are going to be presented without spot or wrinkle, without blemish, holy to Christ. That's to be a description of us. That's what it means to be called out. That's what it means to be part of this group. So this is important. It's important for us to understand what the church is and what it means to be part of that calling out. And we have to live up to that, because Christ shed his blood for each of us, and we need to respond to it. And so the response that we ought to have is similar to what we see in Acts chapter 2, when they were pricked in their hearts, they were cut in their hearts. Because why were they cut in their hearts? Because they heard something about what they had done. They felt guilty. And it cut them to the heart, because they saw through Peter what the great work was that Christ had done. And the one that they had killed, the one that they had nailed to the cross, had done this great thing for them. So they were being called out. And he's called us out of the world into the glorious light of his Son. And so when we are added to that group of saved people, we have a relationship with Christ. That's what we need. And that's what we need to understand that the church is. So let's not have confusion about the church. And maybe this is something that you can use to help others understand that the church is not an institution. The church is not a building. It is the people. And you need to be one of those people. You need to be one of those that are called out, the ones who have made the response to the gospel. If we can help you in any way this morning to respond to the gospel of Christ, we invite you to come while we stand together and sing.
Jesus is standing in Pilate's hall.